Thank you very much for this wonderful presentations, which are so rich that we could probably discuss the whole evening, but we have just 20 minutes, I think, to tip at some points you brought up. Actually, I would like to start with a question which I did not have in mind before I listened to you. That is, time always is a construction of order. So if I already speak of the simultaneity of the non-simultaneous, is this not already framing the issues in a certain kind of order, which is undermining, so to say, the reflexivity you were presenting this evening by bringing out that what is important is that societies are not constructed just by one story, but by a lot of stories, by a lot of narratives. And if you have a lot of narratives, to ask for the simultaneity of them is already to bring them in a kind of order. Who is, so to say, the one who is defining the simultaneity of the different narratives? So, and that, of course, is also a question directly then to history, the science of history, is already the desire to construct orders an attack on the complexity of the narratives. Whoever wants.
I can start. I think it's a point well put, and I think the answer to that is yes, and that's why government control always has a strong element of synchronization. That to organize a society, to control a society, you need to synchronize all those different times. Because, I mean, we construct our own personal times. We construct times that belong to certain collectives, political collectives or any other collective. But for a society to function, you have to create a social rhythm that we have in common. And, I mean, we're on this day when we celebrate the Tag der Deutschen Einheit, that's, I mean, it's a powerful tool of synchronizing Germany and the German collective experience to a common time. So completely, yes, and that synchronizing work is a work that goes on all the time, not just politically, but also historically, obviously, when you make a narrative. You have to do that kind of work of synchronization.
And what is interesting is that the science of history more or less came up at the same time, more or less, with the nation state. So it's also a kind of tool of the nation state to construct it itself. When I saw the story of Slavs and Tatars, my question would be, are the empires not much more equipped to deal with this complex cultural lineages than the nation states itself? Whoever.
Can I pick up on that? Just on the previous point, I think your first question, if I may, really goes to the heart of, I think, what you were talking about in your lecture, that by picking up what we don't normally see or presenting more fragments, we also create a new story, a new narrative, and that has to be acknowledged. I think there's no way around it because we still want to communicate something, but probably the basic starting point would be to be aware of that, to make that transparent, and to put it next to other similarly perhaps fragmentary stories. On the question about empires, I would be hesitant to say that empires have a good track record of accommodating diversity. To some extent, they had to do it, and it's in the nature of the thing. By stretching far and overstretching themselves, eventually they have to manage diversity. It's a control mechanism. And they all function according to differential rights for different groups, and the classical DVD et impera sort of divide and rule tactics, which however at some point seems to run out of possibilities, and usually there's a point when it overreaches itself. And I also don't think we would say that an imperial structure would be the one that can address other issues we face today. So we're clearly dealing also with a very particular political order, which we might say the nation state struggles to accommodate diversity, but I think there are also many examples where that is happening, and is happening at least to some extent successfully. So I wouldn't put the empire in its ability to do so above the nation state.
A direct question to Payam. Yes, you told a narrative. It could be, one could say it's one amongst other narratives, but I think the interesting aspect is, or one interesting, there are many interesting aspects, but one interesting aspect is it's not based on time, at least not on linear time. It's based on images, it's based on narratives, and so on. So what does that mean for you to construct narratives in that way? Is that directly also in order to avoid time as a major system of order?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, I don't understand time at all. And I think that that's in a very practical sense. It's something, duration is something that I think that maybe we have, and we're many, so I'm sure other members of Slavs and Tatars will answer differently, but I can say that I don't understand time at all. I understand space a little bit better, and I think that it's in fact, to come back to what Helga mentioned, this blind spot, actually, whether it's time or space, for me, Russian Orientalism is simply a blind spot, and Slavs and Tatars is, in some sense, a blind spot, not only that, let's say, we, the general populace, have, but we particularly ourselves. So there's this kind of, it's actually, this blindness can be a potential, can be kind of turned to an impetus, in fact, in the sense that, you know, we are not in any way specialists of Russian Orientalism or of this region, and I think that this blind spot vis-a-vis a given narrative is something that, you know, it's in fact always looking for that dark blind spot. Whenever there's a consensus, and in the art world, there's a consensus around Edward Said. In the academic world, there isn't. So as soon as we just saw this, we thought, well, strange that the art world that claims to be a kind of at the forefront of certain types of thought is actually still very much stuck in a paradigm of a dogma of Saidian Orientalism. In similar way that, you know, when we mentioned that whenever there's a consensus about something, whether it's a Tatar legacy or not, that means it's a red flag. Whenever there's a consensus, it means something is terribly wrong because it doesn't allow for that complexity.
Yeah, I just want to come back to the question of narratives and I mean slides, books, images, things, in a sense. And the interesting thing is, if you look at it historically, the urge to tell history in a narrative form is fairly recent. I mean, it's an 18th century invention. And if you look at how knowledge is presented before that, it's much more spatial. I mean, if you look at the Wunderkammer, for instance, these curiosity cabinets where you have all these different objects from different geographies and times and histories, and they're placed in the same room. Some of them are mythological, some of them are sort of historical. It's the unicorn horn, and then it's the sword of someone. And there wasn't this urge to place them chronologically or fit them into one narrative. And I mean, what you're doing has a certain sort of echo of that you allow for things, objects, materials to be combined, to be put alongside each other that doesn't fit in. I mean, you have to struggle really hard to see how they fit into the same narrative, to make that one narrative that we as modern people maybe want to sort of by reflex create. And that's a fascinating thing, I think.
But would you say this kind of narrating objects, so to say, images, is challenging the sciences, for example, political science or historiography, or it's one narrative amongst many others?
Well, I see it as a direct challenge to existing narratives in history and the social sciences. But I think it is, again, going back to your first question, it is another attempt to narrate something, but a different way of narrating it that nicely goes against the national narratives, which are a product of, the European 19th century primarily. But it is still a way of narrating, of storytelling, So I think that recovers something which even a discipline like history that is also about telling the story, or as the social sciences that often want to box things into neat categories and forget the in-between, it's a very useful reminder.
There's a great, I mean, there, to your question of what, as soon as you utter, as soon as you mention a narrative, there's a kind of, who has the power to say that? And I think that there's a great Russian proverb to that effect that says that the future is certain, it's the past which is unpredictable. And that's very much a case of, I think that it's something which is very much a specialty of this region, in a sense, that this constant questioning of, you know, Iranians vis-a-vis their Muslim heritage, Russians vis-a-vis Soviet czarists, you know, it's constantly being questioned. There's never been a continuous or a continuous enough of a history to actually expect the chronology of it that, let's say, maybe you do in the West or one does in the West.
Yeah, and I mean, you are challenging, you're constructing a narrative, but you're also challenging the sort of authority of the narrative, the authoritarian narrative, also by being a collective and not being sort of the narrator that sort of gives us the story and that's it. I mean, it's the anonymity or the collective of the as originators of the work also, would I claim, makes it easier to think more freely about what kind of stories that we can construct as spectators from all these objects and things and fragments.
So this kind of reflection on time, which is in your case just being ignorant about it, you take this image of the step as a major image, which is topography, which to some extent is, let's say, the space of negotiations of narratives. How would you deal with this topography, with this kind of image?
I mean, it's very risky because what you're asking and sometimes what we're accused of is could be construed as reactionary. Are you revising and are you somehow a conservative thinker? And to be honest, I think that sometimes, in at least in today's kind of world, it's sometimes taking a contrary position to what is sort of common wisdom. For example, it's not necessarily essentialist to believe that certain lands create certain rituals and faith systems. So there's a very much a transitional nature to the steppe, and that transitional nature is something which is very much part of this region, right? It is Muslim, but it's not Middle Eastern, it's not Arab or Persian, or even, so those major peoples that we didn't talk about this, but Tatar, the very term Tatar, until today in some sense, but at least at the 20th century, was used as a catch-all for anybody that was non-white, that wasn't an ethnicity we knew. So basically, it wasn't Turkish, wasn't Persian, and wasn't Arab. Everybody else was a Tatar, Armenian, Georgian, and we now, thank God, at least some of us know that there are real Tatars and sort of fictive, sort of Orientalist Tatars. But that very idea is part of these kind of migrating ideas and migrating definitions as much as, let's say, migrating peoples in a literal sense.
Gwen, you were in your talk also referring to imagery as a basis of imaginations. In which sense would you say this differs to the way Slavs and Tatars are using images and tropes?
Differs in a number of ways. Maybe the function of images is similar, but the way in which they're employed is very different. But I think it resonates with some of the examples I was trying to give about a regional resonance of certain stories, certain bits of history, which an insider, whatever that is, in the Crimean context, would readily refer to as a major reference point. But outside, or history has history writing or national narratives from outside, or the Russian, Ukrainian, or Tatar perspective on their own would ignore. So I think that's actually kind of quite similar. The question perhaps is how an image comes about, no? What becomes a lasting image or symbol and what doesn't. And I think at the root of it is partly something has to be told and retold. And one lecture, also by Slavs and Tatars, will not change predominant narratives. One event like the annexation of Crimea will not. But the use of this, again, can create, I think, new images or powerful images that stick.
That's, I think, that's also it's a very interesting, also Byzantine approach to icons and images, which is that I think the image really is something which is very sensual. It has to be somehow activated in an affective manner. We think of these images as things which are outside of ourselves, and I think that's why you have certain prohibitions of imagery, whether it's an icon, sort of certain in iconoclast or in Islam, for example, that the image is really a performative object when it works. Obviously, it's something that you sort of ritualistically return to and repeat. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's especially today, it has no resonance, I think.
And normally in the sciences, the images are used just to illustrate something and are not in that sense, don't have agency in that sense. I think there's a major difference, not between you, but normally the way sciences are treating images and artists are treating images. In the artistic way of treating images, the image gets an agency to work on you. I think that's right. Yeah, to conclude, because Edward Said, of course, for all of us, is a major reference person. And I think you are completely right that the way you have to read Orientalism today is more as a political book, which has to be contextualized in the situation of post-colonial struggle going on. Nevertheless, I mean, the power asymmetries, there are still asymmetries of power today here. And my question would be, how would you imagine Edward Said today, writing today? What would that mean for writing?
I mean, we know something about this, obviously. It's not, I mean, the last edition of Orientalism came out, 10 years ago maybe? And he wrote a new and very, very moving preface, I thought at least, which was about philology. And about sort of German philology and about his fascination for Goethe and Erich Auerbach and those close readers that through close reading were able to sort of enter into other culture in an empathic and humanist way that I thought was, I mean, it's another side to Said, but it's something that I sympathize a lot with also because as we've seen that this tradition of philology as a tool for understanding other cultures should not be reduced to sort of Orientalist gestures, but has another depth to it that we shouldn't forget. So that side to Said is at least something that I'll often come back to.
Payam, for you, it's also a very important point of reference, German philology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the in some sense, you know, the our interest in philology is very similar. It's a kind of attempt to restore this term, which in Western contexts outside of Germany, in the United States and England and France, you don't use this term anymore, philology. It's considered to be sullied, I guess, by National Socialism, by kind of the Ursprache, the kind of what came from 19th century German philology. And that also doesn't do justice to this tradition of philology. That is, if the alternative is linguistics, which is kind of very clinical and talks about sort of your glottal stop and your sort of avuncular lip, and that's that can't sort of encompass the religious, historical importance and complexity of languages, obviously.
I think a minimum change Said would have to make is change the title to Orientalisms, I think, and yeah, he would probably be better off to avoid the term altogether because it, I think, developed its own life, that label. But probably the question that sort of I would pose is also a methodological one. I mean, he chooses the cases that prove his point, And so I think, and that comes out of the later prefaces, I think realizing this to actually pose an open-ended question, and therefore that means you can also be wrong, and you don't just prove already what you think about certain cases would bring the German perspective in or others, and a format would have to be found to present again the multiple perspectives at once, which is probably not the format of a book between two covers written by one person.
I think actually just directly to your question, what would today, in the same way that, let's say, the American right wing has appropriated postmodern, post-critical, sort of post-structuralist thought, as that there's no one narrative, so you hear people saying, that's your facts, that's not our facts, that they've strangely appropriated that. I think that in a similar way, what Putin is doing today is in fact appropriating what was originally leftist critique of Said, turning this Eurasian project towards the West and saying that you are a sort of sinful, degenerate Western society. We are traditional, perhaps autocratic, but we still have tradition, we still have culture, we still respect the sacred, let's say, whether it's sort of Orthodox. And even in recent attempts with opening the mosque, the kind of its attempt to redefine what Islam is, again, to pretty problematic ends. But
okay, thank you very much. I think we covered quite an arena from Edward Said to philology to the Crimea to Russia. Thank you very much for this wonderful presentations, but also discussion. Thank you.